You're listening to the Healthcare Goes Digital podcast. Get ready to be inspired as we explore provocative topics surrounding innovative technologies and ideas with top industry professionals, digital entrepreneurs, and provocateurs. At Impetus Digital, we believe that everything starts with a conversation. We aspire to act as the bridge to not only ignite these courageous conversations, but to also sustain them over time. We do this through our Insight platform, which features our award-winning Insight events and Insight Touchpoint solutions, and through these fireside chats. In the end, our hope is to collectively and positively disrupt healthcare. Let's get started with your host, Natalie Eden, CEO and co-founder of Impetus Digital, an all-in-one, fully serviced virtual collaboration and communication solution for online meetings, events, conferences, and advisory boards for life science companies.
Hi, everybody. My name is Natalie Yeadon, and I'm one of the CEOs and co-founders with Impetus Digital. At Impetus Digital, we have built some of the best-in-class asynchronous and synchronous virtual collaboration and communication tools for life science companies. We worked with companies across the globe for the last 13 years on everything from virtualizing advisory boards, investigator meetings, medical education, treatment pathway profiling, all kinds of things, including corporate events and everything in between. But more importantly, at Impetus, we really believe that everything starts with a conversation. And from these big, hairy, audacious conversations with leading edge thinkers, digital entrepreneurs, provocateurs of the world, we can all work to collectively and positively disrupt healthcare. We also believe that that conversations need to sustain over time. Just like problems don't happen just overnight, they're not solved overnight. So we also like to leverage our platforms for sustained, authentic partnerships and relationship development. So just like these conversations with people like Jerome, is we're really hoping that we can lead the thinking in how we're going to be conducting healthcare moving forward. So I'm really pleased to have Jerome Madison on the show today. He has over 17 years of oncology and precision medicine experience. This includes everything from building and training sales teams to implementing best practices and creating strong and long-lasting relationships with oncology key opinion leaders across the United States. He is actually now using his unique insights into the precision medicine industry and is helping to develop all kinds of products and services that are improving access to care and overall health outcomes in general. And this is being used to accelerate growth for companies and also improving the skills and competencies of leaders and sales talent in the precision medicine industry. So this whole new area that we're going to want to dabble in our discussion today. Jerome is actually the vice president of provider relations at Trapelo and also the host of another podcast called Precision Medicine. And he's also president of Genomic Selling Solutions and a very popular author and a keynote speaker. Welcome, Jerome. So happy to have you on the show.
Natalie, I really appreciate being a guest on your show. Thank you for what you're doing for the industry, just bringing the collective minds and voices together to talk about solutions. And we were just talking before we went live, kind of the green room experience, kind of crowdsourcing. You know, how can we bring these minds together to deliver on the promise of precision medicine? So I'm honored and happy to participate in the fireside chats.
Love it, Jerome. Obviously, a very varied and colorful background, career trajectory. People oftentimes like to listen to people who come into positions like yourself at a VP level, you know, podcaster, running, you know, popular author. How did you get to where you got to? Did you always have your eye on this, or was it just happenstance or just great luck? How did you land in the positions you're in today?
Wow. So that's a loaded question, but I'm always happy to share this journey of the development of the industry of precision medicine. So when I started back in 2004, if you remember probably the couple of years prior, that was the completion of the Human Genome Atlas project, right? And I got into the industry having no prior experience. It was really you know, it was divine, I would say, because I came into the right mentors. And the company that I interviewed for was called Oncotech, Oncology Technology, based in Orange County, California. And they had the first fresh tissue assay that you harvested cells to identify chemo resistance, what's likely not to work for a patient. And there were some companion diagnostics or correlative biomarkers that correlated to response or non-response to chemotherapy. Now, again, back in 2004, there wasn't many targeted therapies. There was only one, which is probably Herceptin, if you want to call hormone receptor, you know, those are certainly targeted therapies, but not nearly where we are today. So in that job, as a district manager, what we had to do was go into hospitals and really kind of teach the philosophy of personalized medicine in cancer and how to deselect certain therapies for patients. Now I'm telling you, I laugh with some of my colleagues who are leading organizations, who are CEOs of their own companies. Most of the folks that I work with back then, we still keep in contact because we were the Israelites, if you will. I mean, we were literally kind of like forerunners of this message of personalized medicine. And we think and laugh about the resistance that we got from people using these types of tools. And what we had to do then, I mean, today when someone orders a genetic profile or a genomic profile, you don't even think what has to happen between you filling out a requisition and getting a report. But literally we had to go into the operating room, educate the surgeons of all kinds, neurosurgeons, breast surgical oncologists, surgical oncologists who do hepatobiliary surgeries, any number of cancer surgical specialists. I have over 20,000 hours of experience in the OR teaching how to harvest tumor cells to get these types of results. And over that time, you would resect a tumor from a brain. It would go to pathology where they do frozen section to confirm the cancer. I mean, I followed the tissue at every point of the journey from the patient's body. I've looked at cancer of every histology under a microscope, talked to the techs that handle the tissue, the pathologists who make the reads, how to package and procure that tissue to send it out to a lab. When it's in the lab, how the cells are broken down from connective tissue and those types of things. So every part of the process I knew very well. Over that time, the conversation hasn't changed of how we identify and use these tools to identify who's most likely or least likely to respond to certain therapies, but the technology has been revolutionary. Now we can get the same information where we have to go, sit out in an OR and make sure that the cells are harvested properly. And we can get this information now on, a blood draw or an archive block, and in some cases urine or saliva in some cases. So I've been having the same conversations, teaching and growing KOLs in the industry, working with the different medical societies, the fellowship groups that are teaching students about this new paradigm of precision medicine. And it's been an honor to really watch the industry grow, teach best practices, be able to coach and manage some of the most talented people in the industry, and watch it flourish into different segments.
Beautiful. Love it. And I actually have to giggle a little bit there because I was actually very involved at Genentech at the time. We launched Herceptin adjuvant breast cancer. And again, we're the pioneers with these, new testing that was happening. And again, launching Eresa with EGFR testing and way back in the earlier days when you're just coming up with these new lab centers of excellence. And now it's just something that people just, they don't even think about it. So it's so interesting how things quickly evolve. Yeah. So let's actually talk for a few minutes about Trapelo. What is Trapelo and what makes it unique in a relatively getting kind of crowded marketplace?
Yeah, so Trapelo is the first clinical decision support tool that infuses prior authorization into the clinical workflow. And what's interesting is there are technology tools that clinicians use. And when you talk about clinical decision support, it's not sexy, at all. we know that clinical decision support pathways, they work with being able to practice evidence-based medicine. And in a real sense, for precision medicine, the knowledge is growing so rapidly. The business of next generation cancer care is growing rapidly, not only for clinicians, but also for payers, right? And also technology has advanced. So what we seek to do is solve the challenges that have arisen out of the rapid growth of the data, the science, technology, and the business of next generation cancer care. And our answer to that is Trapelo. Trapelo is used as a clinical decision support tool by clinicians as they have to order a profile for a patient, not only a molecular profile, but think about just the breadth of different types of diagnostics that will now be a predictive test for a therapy or even a prognostic test in some cases for therapy surrounding precision medicine. That's leveraging your DNA, your genome to inform treatment decisions. It's almost unmanageable. And I always share this, this conversation when we were developing the tool 3-4 years ago. We went in and talked to a group of medical oncologists, three of them. One of them is an MD PhD and did his PhD work on cell biology back in the 70s. So to him, comprehensive molecular profiling was like, his favorite condiment. Like he wanted it for everybody, couldn't get enough of it, We asked the second physician, how do you decide what to order? He says, well, if I have to order, it's after the patient has failed standard therapies, advanced on therapies that we know that are available to them. And he would do just a broad-based, 700, 500 gene panel to make sure he doesn't miss anything. But then we talked to the third doctor and said, well, how do you decide what to order and when? He says, well, I have a sticky. a sticky, like a post-it note, and he has that by his desk, and he says, I tell my nurse to go order a profile for so-and-so, but his concern was he didn't want to overtest. He didn't want to have uncomfortable conversations around financial toxicity, uncertainty around reimbursement of these tests and the drugs that may reveal that the patient may benefit from. So he wanted just to order the biomarkers that have shown an FDA approved therapy, and he had them written on a sticky. Now, this would be funny if it wasn't for the fact that he was very proud of that. And in his mind, he was doing exactly what the patient needed. And I share this example of kind of what's happening across the country with how the adoption of biomarkers and companion diagnostics are playing out with the growth of precision medicine. There is such a disparity in the level of understanding, its clinical utility, the comfort level of ordering different tests. And again, we're not talking just about comprehensive molecular profiling. We're talking about when do you order a genetic test? When do you order a blood biopsy blood biopsy for risk assessment or detecting disease? What does the data say? And after that's all said and done, will the insurance pay for the test and the associated therapies? And so Trapelo serves as that one stop in the clinic to go to that everyone can share knowledge across a network to make sure they're at least offering precision medicine uniformly to patients across that practice, because it's very likely without these tools that two patients can walk into the same practice and get very different care based on the level of understanding or comfort of the clinicians who are treating them.
Oh, absolutely. What an amazing way to piece an extremely complicated ecosystem. And we all know, any of us who have been in the oncology world, that there's no end to number of things that have to be untangled as part of the cancer patient journey. So let's actually just linger for a few minutes on this concept of precision medicine. This has literally become a bit of a buzzword, maybe a little bit overused and become a bit of a cliche, but there's real meaning behind it. And I wonder if you can sort of paint the picture to what the world looked like before, the original biomarkers or the original sort of single mutation tests, and what precision medicine has evolved into today's current state and understanding?
Wow, that's a loaded question. So I guess I'll approach it like this. You know, precision medicine, it's that question is, what is precision medicine? You know, there's a lot of people who define it different ways. If you speak to clinicians, they would suggest that all healthcare is precision because there are things to consider, unique patient characteristics from one patient to the next that must be considered in order to get and recommend the right therapies for that patient. So in that case, it can be precise to that patient. Now, precision medicine, as we see it, is the ability to implement technological tools, technology, software, solutions in order to integrate them into the clinical workflow that would eliminate barriers and friction, like financial uncertainty of coverage of these different tests and therapies, like the unwanted variability in testing in the clinic from one physician to the next of their level of understanding. Back then when I was just speaking in 2004, we were the only game in the United States, literally. But after that, there were a couple labs that came forward with assays, but it was only around 2012 when next-gen sequencing had been commercialized that you see this real growth of labs in the country that were offering different testing panels or lab products that you could scan or sequence genomes and identify patients who are likely to respond to certain diseases. I mean, now we're talking about use cases in multiple tumor types, multiple biomarkers. Some of these biomarkers will only target, great example is, you know, RET fusions or RET mutations. It only affects 3% of medullary thyroid cancer patients, but it has a 63% response rate. So that's about, you know, 1,000 patients a year, right, that have the ability to benefit from that. And in every tumor type, there is a biomarker that can, you know, segment a certain percentage of the population who can benefit. The information is growing so rapidly. The data is growing so rapidly. Drugs and different biomarkers are coming to the market so rapidly that, you know, most clinicians, if you're not a specialist in a certain tumor type, it's hard to keep up with the data. It's hard to understand who to order for, at what point in their treatment journey, what biomarkers to consider, what lab can actually do the test that needs to be done, what lab product has the biomarkers. And oh, of course, when you get the report back, how do you interpret that information? They're all, you know, 38 pages long, the information's on different pages of the report. And ultimately, you have to get in line and enter another portal for your payer to know if they're likely to pay for it. And that creates a lot of friction. It creates a lot of unreadiness and hesitancy on the part of the clinician to the point where they don't do the testing. They don't even, you know, start the first step to see if a patient could actually get access to a therapy because it's a lot of time taken out of the physician's, you know, schedule to have to get on and fight with the payer to even get access. So precision medicine really is involving tools, creating, and that's what Trapelo is. It's really a user-friendly interface that helps a healthcare system, a cancer center, practice precision medicine that fits their workflow and makes it more efficient to make these treatment decisions and orders. And also, which we didn't mention, the B use case is for payers. They need a utilization management tool that provides them the type of insight into the data to help them understand what should be paid for every single time and really skip the process of, you know, mother may I, if you will, or you know, going to appeal a denied claim when there's a clear indication for a therapy for a patient. So that's how we define it here at Trapelo Health. And through the podcast, we talk to a number of experts, thought leaders, scientists, patient advocates about how we can together solve the problem and deliver on the promise of precision medicine.
I love it. Let's actually start from the very beginning as we think about the process of a cancer patient's journey. So the first piece is really around tissue. And sometimes it comes from a place where a patient is already going to a surgical oncologist and they're already having surgery, or they were diagnosed a little later, either with a medical oncologist or somebody else or a family doctor. There's a little bit of a swirl that goes on, and with swirl comes inefficiency and time gaps, right? So the longer it takes for diagnosis, et cetera. So tell us a little bit around some of the current issues and situations around tissue cell collection and some of the things that you have intervened in terms of accelerating that swirl so that we can get to diagnosis sooner and faster.
Well, I guess historically, and I'll go back to, 17 years ago, one thing that we were very vocal about, and, for the pathologist as a professional is vital to everything that is done because it's their decision that triggers every treatment decision that comes after. And we felt that pathology was just the key linchpin to everything that happens in the world of precision medicine because they, for lack of a better term, they kind of own that tissue, right? So what they did with it, in many cases, we needed back then about, we used to say a thumbnail or the size of a Tic Tac. So we would encourage them to make an additional block because someday in the future, if this is a patient, who's first diagnosed, newly diagnosed, you're going to need an additional block to do molecular profiling or gene sequencing on this patient for different reasons. And, the topic or the rate limiting factor for adoption has always been reimbursement or the lack thereof. So the pathology groups that we worked with back then really didn't see the value of having a second block because that meant more tissue storage. And if you think about it, some of these tumors get really large. If you pull a tumor out the size of your fist, they're only keeping this much of it, right? So the conversation back then was, to see the long-term value of where and how to apply precision medicine and where the utility of the information is really valuable as patients progress. Weren't a lot of targeted therapies, weren't a lot of, biomarkers or companion diagnostics in the primary care setting, the primary setting of cancer to leverage or to test for. But now, fast forward, 15, 16 years, you have chemo-free regimens for lung cancer, right? And they're trying to get to that point in other diseases. So I'm not sure what the conversation is now, but what we know is there are teams that have been deployed not only from the myriad of labs, just the overabundance of labs that deploy a sales force to go out to work with pathology on harvesting, adequate tissue to test. There are pharma companies that have scaled teams of reps, and they're not even selling anything. Their job is to really go work with pathology and in the clinic to educate them about the utility of biomarker testing. So, the aggregate knowledge level of its clinical utility is raised in the marketplace. And when you think about that, one thing we speak from is an IQVIA research study that was published in August of 2020, just last year. And what it showed is the biomarker adoption rate over the last 10 years. And on average, the two things that really stood out was it takes an average of 5 years to reach 80% adoption of a specific biomarker. There's a lot to be said about what the sample size was and how they did the research. But if that's the best effort of all the resources that are being spent on educating the market, an average adoption of 5 years to 80%, that is completely inadequate and unacceptable for the number of cancer patients who could benefit from a therapy, or at least know that there's a therapy out there by just being aware that there is a biomarker that can be predictive of a certain, test. So we feel that tools, user-friendly technological tools that fit the clinician's workflow, point-of-care tools, even that allow access or transparency from a payer perspective to see why the test is being ordered, that it gives them as much information as possible to know that they should be paying for that test and the subsequent therapies that are realized. That's how we really feel that the promise is going to be delivered. And in that process, you know, maybe there's a value for pathology to figure out kind of the issue around tissue, how to harvest better specimens, their internal policies. And that's kind of what we were teaching 17 years ago. So
it's always going to come down to that quality assurance, how big, how often, how soon. So those are, I think, going to be the promise of the future. One of the things that's really interesting when we talk about oncologists, whatever brand you happen to be, surgical, radiation, you know, medical, et cetera. And, you know, one of the things that we're all creatures of habit. At the end of the day, our brains are lazy and we like to do the things that are automatic for us, right? So integration and interoperability within the workflow is so absolutely essential if anybody wants to systematize something like biomarkers, diagnostics, and, you know, being able to integrate precision medicine decisions. So you were telling or alluding a little bit to that. Tell us a little bit about that, the app, how you're facilitating communication between the various players as the patient is progressing through the diagnosis piece before a decision is being made of what treatment you're going to have based on all of these evaluations and this diagnostics that we've just had. And now we've decided we're going to have this. So how are you integrating this and operationalizing this?
Well, operationalizing precision medicine is the key, right? So what it stems from is that all the stakeholders need a knowledge base that they can leverage. There's data and then there's data, right? You know, depending on, you know, who you listen to or what lab or what, you know, what group. What we do is we will call the highest levels of evidence that are going to be, you know, level one, level two, 2B evidence into our database as a tool to help payers, clinicians leverage that knowledge when they really need it. And from that knowledge base, you put it into the clinical workflow. So our tool is designed to integrate into an EMR or a laboratory information system. However, they currently order testing for a patient. It's usually, you know, some internal system. And we call Trapelo, or we don't call Trapelo, one of our amazing customers, Texas Oncology, is called Trapelo the easy button. And the purpose of that is when you have to order a diagnostic test, a molecular test, a liquid biopsy, a test for, you know, risk assessment, you can get a trigger when you're inside of your EMR ordering for that patient, or you can push a button that opens Trapelo and it takes you down a patient survey asking specific questions about the patient's condition. Have they been treated with certain things before? And it kicks out a recommendation at the end of that 4 or 5 question survey that says, hey, here are the markers that you should consider testing for this patient. The tool is configurable. We have a point of view based on the level of evidence, what should be recommended. But if this health system has a preferred laboratory or lab product, they can choose to configure their pathways however they want. What Trapelo gives them is the infrastructure to be able to place that in their clinical workflow to ensure that every physician who's treating a similar patient, that information comes up as far as what biomarkers should be tested for that particular patient. They could select, they could deselect that. And it also gives insight for the healthcare network as to how the users are complying to their pathways. We know that pathways work when it comes to compliance. And what can be done through that also with the payer from a provider standpoint is they can, you know, go and negotiate a higher rate of reimbursement for their services because they can prove that they practice precision medicine, whether it's a value-based care contract, quality care initiatives. The challenge is without these tools, there's no way to measure how you're performing. And if you can't measure it, you can't manage a program. And if you can't manage it, you can't take those insights to healthcare payers to negotiate the reimbursement that you should have, right? So on the payer side, you know, it's a matter of helping them understand how large the problem is. because, you know, prior authorization is kind of like the standard, you know, modus operandi, you know, for getting access to a lot of these tests, because the labs go at risk and say, hey, we'll do the testing and then we'll fight it out. Well, with Trapelo, because the payer would use, you know, our database as that third party arbiter of the information as to what should be paid for, it streamlines the process and provides reimbursement assurance for certain labs on their products. So it's a way, it's a win-win situation for everyone we see. It's very difficult to create a solution that benefits all stakeholders, but that's really the vision of the company. In fact, the word Trapelo is Latin. It means to pull together. And, you know, there's no way that we can really deliver on the promise of precision medicine if we don't align the incentives of all stakeholders. And that's what we seek to do through.
So what is it? Can you give us a concrete example? You don't have to give any names away for per se, but when you're talking about there's a win-win that's happening for everybody here, there's an evaluation of cost savings in this bucket translating into higher reimbursement in this bucket. What can you share an example of how that worked for particular, diagnosis or a therapeutic space or what have you, to show like a concrete example of how that transpired using Trapelo?
Yeah, so in Texas, we've got great traction in the state of Texas. And from a clinical use perspective, and I'll talk about this is kind of how the ordering process goes. So, you know, Dr. Jones says to their assistant, order, you know, profile, order a test for, you know, the patient in room one. Well, that person who's also very busy has to find whatever requisition of the lab that they want to order. You know, these requisitions can be very busy, right? Look like almost sushi menus where it's a lot of boxes, and hopefully they don't, you know, mess up the order through human error because it won't get activated. It's faxed off at some point during the day. If any information is left off of that requisition, they have to call back and interrupt clinic, get the, you know, additional information out of the EMR or patient in history, patient treatment notes. And then there's a lag time between the lab reaching out to the hospital where whoever possesses that block to get it in-house, start the testing and deliver it back. Right. So what we've been able to do is shave an average of 48 hours off of that process because we've taken them off of the paper and automated that process, taken the ordering process. And this is a direct quote from one of the users here in Texas. We took what used to be a 2-hour process down to 10 minutes, right? So that's a tangible savings that results in monetary savings. Now, we haven't published the insights and we haven't been able to put, you know, the dollars and cents behind what those savings mean. But in a real sense, you know, what can be done if we're giving, you know, 2 hours a day back to the clinic staff? What can be done? Because from a payer perspective, precision medicine and, you know, managing these claims are an administrative and an economic burden for them as well. So what can be done if we streamline this process and had a tool that serves as a sense of truth for everyone as to what should be paid for every single time for a patient, and, you know, avoiding prior authorizations and uncertainty around, you know, reimbursement. And I think with that level of adoption, both clinically, it encourages payers to seek a solution for this precision medicine that is quickly, it's upon them now. So if they're not thinking about how they're going to manage their precision medicine spend while improving outcomes.
Yeah, so Jerome, another quick question on that same point though, is when you're intervening and you're already figuring out what the business rules are for that organization or that region or that territory or state or what have you, and you build that in to the evaluation or the EMR systems or systems, is there something also integrated within that evaluation of timeliness at which a patient will get managed and the final patient reported outcomes or the outcomes for that patient? Is there anybody studying that on the fact that there isn't a huge delay on the diagnosis, or, you know, that whole piece there that's kind of going back and forth, or there was a delay or something didn't get reimbursed? Do you have any data to support that? And in addition, if the right tests were done at the right time, at the right place with the right patients, getting better outcomes, and you were suggesting something about some sort of a cost-benefit analysis discussion with the payer. So can you speak a little bit about some of the advantages there?
Yeah, so at this point, we don't have enough data to publish around because the tool has only been on the market for 18 months. To date, we have over 600 users on the system. We've processed over 3,500 orders to many of the major labs, central labs that will do sequencing for different reasons. So the response has been enormous from patients, but we're not at a point yet where we can look back and publish these insights from turnaround time to treatment, right? So that's not the use case for Trapelo clinically to track kind of those real world outcomes. There are other tools and other processes in which you can combine these data points to develop that, but that's where we're headed, to be able to combine these different data points and put this in a paper that shows the time, the cost savings that are associated both with the clinic and with the payer participating in such a program.
Awesome. It's beautiful. And at the end of the day, there's other beneficiaries of systems and of tests like yourselves and like Trapelo, which is really on the pharma side. Everything from clinical trials to understanding, you know, patient screening consistency. Can you talk a little bit about the pharma and pharmaceutical companies being the beneficiaries of working or integrating or utilizing a company like Trapelo?
Yeah, there's a lot of value for the pharma industry for you know, knowing about Trapelo and understanding how we work. You know, it's literally a patient access issue. If patients aren't tested for a certain aberration, you can't get the therapy to them, right? There are a few immunotherapies out there that show that, you know, it doesn't have a companion diagnostic, you can write them. But, you know, the common question is, don't you want to know, right? If you give someone a PD-L1 inhibitor, don't you want to know how much they're expressing and are likely to benefit from that therapy to be able to save excess toxicity, excess cost, and, you know, the suffering from the patient who could have benefited from a therapy if they knew that there was a target there for them. So, I mean, there's a lot of value from a patient education, a patient access standpoint. But the other point is, in broad scale deployment of such a tool, we talked about the sales forces that go out and educate the market about biomarker utility. Well, there's really not a tool that they can look and see how effective they're being. How do they know that their efforts are actually, you know, beneficial with more patients being tested for a specific biomarker? There's no tool besides Trapelo that would provide that kind of insight to them to show how effective their efforts are and can help them correct their messaging or targeting efforts to raise that bar. And then, you know, lastly, you talked about clinical trials. Trapelo has a use case, and there's a lot of dynamism built into the tool. Clinical decision support is its core functionality for the clinic, but there is an ability to help increase screening rates. So in an instance where there is a biomarker in clinical trials, so the tool will recommend biomarkers where there's a high degree of evidence, meaning there's an FDA therapy on the market or a clinical trial available. But if there's a therapy that's coming to the market, the network can set up their, you know, treatment pathway or their survey to identify patients with a KRAS G12C to get, you know, in their network, be able to identify these patients who have this aberration who would likely benefit from that therapy as it becomes commercially available. So it increases the screen rate for clinical trials, and they build a data asset of their patients that is queryable for themselves to identify who they have in their network that could be available for new indications for therapy, such as PARP inhibitors that are getting new indications for different diseases, new drugs coming to the market, and clinical trials as well that come into a certain network.
Beautiful. Oh, just a very exciting place where you have taken things in the diagnostic space and in the testing and the precision medicine space. So I just want to kind of get a little excited because I'm a real digital geek and I want to accelerate our thinking a little bit about what the future looks like from the beginning to the very end. So let's actually think a little bit on this whole thing around capturing tissue. And I know that you alluded to this idea of liquid biopsies, which is really becoming very popular. And I think popularized because in some ways we were forced to do this with more, you know, halting of clinical trials because of COVID and people having to accelerate thinking around how do we get the information that we need so that we can continue with clinical trials and other sorts of things. And one of these was really around liquid biopsies. And you were alluding to some of this. Tell us a little bit about in the imagination and what things are going to look like in the future around people using regular devices, ambient biometrics, other sorts of devices where there is almost like a seamlessness and entry of these kinds of information without having to even do surgeries. What do you think that's going to look like in the not so distant future?
Well, you know, and this is, I'm going to repeat some things that we've probably all heard, but those types of capabilities exist already in other industries, like banking and investments. And those are some of the most intimate details of our life. But, you know, I can pick up my phone and look up, you know, my retirement and my stocks. And, you know, if I'm in another country, I could probably still access, you know, my bank account. But we can't do that for healthcare. Like, I literally cannot access my own patient chart. Well, I can because I have a portal, which I don't know the password. But that's what it's going to look like. I mean, I have an Apple Watch on, right? There are so many features about my overall personal health that can be monitored and accessed through my Apple Watch. Well, I think, you know, healthcare from a, you know, cancer care perspective, precision medicine, however you want to say it, is going to kind of be the same thing. And it comes to a point to where, you know, there is a convergence of technology happening in the market, right? So there are technologies and software solutions that have advanced parallel to one another. And so now we're able to put together a system that can facilitate next generation cancer care. Listen, we'll go back about 10 years, right? So we always ask, you know, what's the rate limiting factor for adopting these tools in healthcare? What's the rate limiting factor for adopting technology? It's technology itself. If we go back 10 years ago, when practices adopted electronic medical records, they didn't do it because it was a great idea. They did it because it was a federal mandate. You know, the government made them switch to electronic medical records. And so that if that's, we can want to consider that Gen 1, and it wasn't because they were using certain, you know, technological tools before then. So you have your EMR, you have laboratory information systems. Every stakeholder, whether it is the provider, hospital network, the payers, pharma, everyone uses a lot of disparate technologies that are siloed in their own industry. So I think COVID and, you know, the pandemic taught us more so than anything that now is the time to start leveraging these tools. So in the instance where we can't come together to have consultations on patients, we can't come together and actually go face to face with our doctor. There are a number of tools that we can use to get the same high level of quality care, whether that is telemedicine, whether that is machines that will, you know, read your pathology and send those slides, being able to deliver a kit to someone's home to get a biological sample. There's so many tools available. It's just a matter of, you know, the different stakeholders in the healthcare system coming together and, you know, knowing, you know, a lot of times the last thing we know is what to do first, right? So it's likely to come to that, and we'll have, you know, hey, our sequencing.
It is a fascinating area, including the topic of where artificial intelligence and machine learning fits into this equation. And I'd love to get the Trapello or your personal perspective on what this looks like. Everything from, are we going to see an eventual replacement of the diagnostician or the pathologist and using AI algorithms to the point where we only have to have a few samples because we're going to have much more predictive analytics built into these algorithms? to how surgeries are done and to the ultimate decisions of what treatments are going to be administered. Tell us a little bit about what you see AI in terms of hindering, helping, why people are afraid or why they should be embracing this.
I think, you know, obviously, all innovation is good for patients, right? How to best answer that question? So I had a conversation on our podcast. The very first person that we interviewed was Dr. Magliacocco, who was the chair of the H. Lee Moffitt pathology program at the time. And one interesting topic, talking about pathology, right? I used to hear that anything that doesn't touch a patient is going to be replaced with technology, right? Mm-hmm. So pathology, and let's think about this. So we know how genetic counselors, how vital they are to the healthcare system, right? So an entire specialty was created in curriculum to reach this level of certification to be a genetic counselor, because we need those people who, this is, they're the resident experts. They will consult you. The doctors depend on them. But when you look at, you know, genomic alterations that we develop that are predictive for certain therapies, who's the expert there, right? And the one thing that we said with Dr. Magliacocco is, could pathology reinvent themselves to be patient-facing now, to be that resident expert of these types of tests and what it means to patients? Because, you know, we all get, can go get a 23andMe or these things and get a bunch of information. They have a great portal. I did it, you know, 4 years ago, and I still don't know half the things. But in, you know, pathology, if they are willing to take ownership of this and actually, you know, consult with patients, it's a new spin on, you know, their industry. And again, they talk about being replaced by a machine. You still need a person to read those things and interpret that to another human being. So I don't think the tools will come to replace. I think that we as people just innovate them into, you know, forward thinking and how healthcare should be. I don't think we should be, you know, anybody's going to be replaced by these tools. But if you become complacent about not developing your skill set and not innovating and keeping up with the innovation that's happening in the space, you could easily be replaced if you're complacent.
I love the concept of, as well, of where we're going with genomic testing. Back in the day when I was in oncology, it was very much what you were talking about, which is these single mutation tests and the way, you know, we archaically did biomarker testing, et cetera, to a place now where we're talking about whole genome testing. Tell us a little bit about what the future of that looks like. And more importantly, can we see a day where we're truly fostering this concept of wellness, and that every person that's born is actually mandated for getting a genomic test, and that their N equals one assessment of their own wellness is actually attached or associated with their own genome and their own personal wellness metrics? What can you say about that and the way we've traditionally been doing management of people's diagnostics and testing?
Yeah, I think it's all dependent upon having a knowledge base that the layperson can access to make that information meaningful. If you get a test and you don't know what to do with it, or it just simply scares patients into thinking that I'm going to develop a disease early in my life, that can be kind of rather depressing, right? So who wants that? But if you have a knowledge base that you can organize this information to give, you know, practical applications about lifestyle alterations or things to look out for, lifestyle choices that you can make today, or specialists that you would want to consult with, it makes it a lot more relevant, and it makes those tools much more useful, right, to put into play. And because I think if we have a database that we can leverage to make that information more meaningful, I think payers would be more apt to reimburse for it, because there is a decision to be made that can translate into, better healthcare cost, better patient outcomes. But the studies would have to be done to make those associations with technology. And we need those, forward thinking payers. We need those forward thinking administrators in healthcare systems that are willing to say, okay, you know, I see this the same way, and here's a path to success, instead of foregoing adopting technology for profits, right? Let's keep doing what we're doing until we absolutely have to do something different because we understand what this does to our bottom line. And adopting new technology many times disrupts that.
Absolutely. And I just want to get your perspective as well too, is that future thinking around people perhaps, you know, maybe from the day that they're born, have this genomic test and they have this predictor, this opportunity to assess the lifestyle decisions that they're making along their life's journey. A bioethical question that comes to the table would be, is there a place for monitoring or what some people would call surveillance? And is there a fine line between that and, for example, payers reimbursing or activating certain behaviors or incentivizing certain behaviors versus people, and is there a fine line between people making personal decisions based on self activities or self-responsibility about the right decisions to make? It's a kind of a fine line because where is surveillance lead to proper behavior activation versus de-incentivization for people feeling free and living their life the way they want it? What is your sense around what the future of this could look like?
We have to figure out a way to align the incentives for payers to endorse that, right? In many cases, these tools are available today, but you know, someone has to pay out of pocket. If there is growing evidence that certain behaviors can lead to, you know, delayed disease progression, earlier detection, lifestyle choices that keep you out of the hospital, that keep your healthcare, you know, spend low, you know, maybe that incentives is cheaper health insurance or life insurance or some of those things. So we just have to find a way to align the incentives to make sure that, you know, when you're driving, you know, volume or demand for a certain product, that there is, you know, a light at the end of the tunnel that, you know, a healthcare provider or a payer, for instance, there's an incentive there for them to recommend to their patients because it keeps them out of the hospital, it keeps them out of the clinic. You know, coming from where I come from, my dad used to say all the time, there's no money in cure, right? So maybe we align incentives to keep people healthy, better rebates for, you know, employer insurance programs and things of that nature. So we just have to find a way to align the incentives to where people can promote those types of tools and programs in order to drive adoption.
Yeah, it's beautifully said. And I think that's a very, what I call systems thinking approach, where at the bottom line, it always comprises of people making decisions. And it really comes down to incentivization. At the same time, there is a question ultimately about some of the things that we're talking about around precision medicine, having ammunition and information at your fingertips to make the right and appropriate personal decisions about how to live your life in a healthful way. And then also taking some certain personal accountability to making those decisions, as well as maybe some incentivization for it. But it does actually beg the question around equalization and the democratization of all of these things that we're talking about. I was speaking with somebody recently on our podcast that was talking about people paying $15,000, they get a genomic test, and then they formulate every possible concoction of drug formulations out there and determine the one that you're genetically going to respond to, and then outcomes the outcome. There's a certain level of money that's required in this. There's a certain level of access required for these apps, for these decisions, for access to care. Can you tell us a little bit about your thoughts on inclusivity and what this is looking like in this sort of K economy that we're finding ourselves in?
You know, that's it's a great question. And it's one of the questions that I'm actively trying to solve with partners in the industry. We feel that we just talked about the emergence and convergence of tools, technology in the marketplace. I mean, it all comes down to, can we put tools in patients' hands that empowers them on their health, right? For earlier detection. And those tools can't be cost prohibitive. You know, it should be a free app that's sponsored by, you know, someone, because the more they know, if we're talking about a disease like breast cancer, right? Can we get an app to women that, you know, that helps them identify, you know, certain changes or things like that, and that would recommend, hey, go to a screening. Here's a local place to do that. You know, men for prostate cancer or any other disease that, you know, is sponsored by industry, that is not the point to put them on a certain drug or to advertise, you know, certain products, but it's patient information and education. And you tie that to patient advocacy groups that, you know, happen locally that can help with transportation to healthcare. There, we need resources like that to be able to get the community at large engaged, and they can't be cost prohibitive, because that creates, you know, more disparities in healthcare. So I think it comes back to the conversation of, you know, how we're developing technological tools to put in the hands of the public so they can take ownership of this. And it democratizes in many ways the data that we can get to quickly improve, you know, outcomes and inform what's working and what's not.
I love it. And I think this is a great way to land the conversation at the top of this hour. I love the idea of the empowerment of the patient, the digital citizen, whatever, the healthcare consumer. And I think it's going to be a very exciting world in the next 5 to 10 years. I can't wait to dig in. I'm sure you would as well. I want to thank everybody who's taking some time to listen to this discussion. We will be leaving Jerome Madison's contact details. If anybody's interested in speaking with him, getting on his podcast, or just looking at leveraging his company's tools, if you're a pharmaceutical company or otherwise, I'm sure he's going to be very happy to speak with you. We also encourage you to check out impetusdigital.com. If you enjoy this conversation and you yourself are an organization that are looking for ways of optimizing your clinical trials, having discussions around the best types of diagnostics and biomarkers, or taking a look at evaluations of the cost utility, et cetera, we can bring stakeholders from across the globe, patients, payers, physicians, and have these conversations over time or synchronously through the Insight platform. Please like or subscribe to our channel so you can actually hear about new notifications and hear about new content that we're dealing with. We want to thank everybody for their time. Jerome, Madison, this has been an absolutely pleasure speaking with you today, and wishing you all a great day ahead.
Thank you for listening to this Healthcare Goes Digital podcast. Impetus Digital are the business-to-business virtual engagement experts and provide immersive virtual collaboration and communication solutions for advisory boards, medical education meetings, events, conferences, and projects worldwide, all delivered with our award-winning white glove service. Visit us at impetusdigital.com or book a demo at meetwithimpetus.com to find out more. And visit us on our LinkedIn, Twitter, and YouTube channel to see other inspiring conversations for you to share with your network.